It's Thursday, November 10th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 250 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
This is John.
And this is Chris.
We are now at episode 250, which means we are officially closer to 300 than 200.
And we are one quarter of the way to episode 1000, which will be hosted on Richard Garriott's space station.
That's right. We are going to do episode 1000 with guest host Lord British in space. Two announcements. First off, Fear the Con 5 coming up in May of 2012. Don't forget to get out there and get signed up for that. By the time this episode drops, hopefully I will have my first event posted, and I'm going to have started the drawing for the one slot in which I'll be running the D. Wayne system. Wayne said I can only run it once, so I'm going to give everyone an even chance. I'll run a random drawing that'll go over the course of about 2 or 3 months to see who the players are going to be. But I'll get that closed out plenty of time so that people who don't win can find other activities and such.
From Wayne's sly little smile I'm seeing here, I wouldn't want to be a player character in that universe.
The other thing that I wanted to announce, or at least remind, because I haven't mentioned this in a while, is on March 24th through April 1st of 2012, Pat and I will be going on the Gamer Adventure Cruise, which is a cruise sponsored by Kemp, who's a travel agent that I got to know through Gamma and some other stuff. And it's a great Caribbean cruise, a lot of fun. I already know there's some Fear of the Booters signed up to go. Actually, none of them have self-identified, but Kim has said that they've indicated that's how they found her. So I know they're out there.
It's a good trip. I cannot go this year, but if you have the means, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, so we're going to be on that. So if you have the ability to go on the cruise, then be sure to check out the show notes for links and whatnot to that.
This is the first time you and I have been on the mics together in a while, Dan.
Yeah, it is, actually, because you were off for a while, and then I took 2 weeks off, and so yeah.
How's it going?
We took two recording weeks off. I don't think we've recorded with you, Dan, in time, strictly speaking, in 3 weeks or even a month.
Yeah.
I'd say I can't complain, actually, but Chris, it is my firm belief that anyone who can't complain lacks either imagination or ambition, so.
I apparently have plenty of both.
We started this thing, your ambition was to do the podcast. Now your ambition is to not. Jesus, Dan, the grass is always greener.
What? I didn't say anything of the sort. I talk about life in general, not the podcast.
Okay.
If my ambition is not to do the podcast, you'd be shocked how easy that is to complete.
That's what I was wondering.
Anyway, all right, let's get into a gaming topic here. What I want to talk about is something that came up in our Battletech campaign, but I've had it come up in other campaigns as well. In trilogy movies or trilogy books, there is, I don't know, we'll call it a trope. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but it's something that I really hate, which is you get the bridge book, the bridge movie, where they can't set things up the way they were in the first movie, and they can't really bring it to the climax because that's the third movie. So they have to sort of meander about. For some reason, we as an audience or as consumers are just supposed to accept that it's a bridge story and therefore it's going to suck.
The middle installment of a story like that can be amazing. It can be the best part. Go watch Empire Strikes Back.
No, I completely agree. I'm simply saying that a lot of people, I think, get lazy in creating that because, well, all I'm doing is connecting the start and the finish.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily even lazy. I think that sometimes there's ebbs and flows to a story. There's a lot of setup, and then there's climax, and then there's sort of you're dealing with the aftermath, and then you're picking up the next part of the climax, and you're building to that. Well, that dip between the two climaxes where you're kind of tying up loose ends and starting up new
or
stories.
Losing.
Yeah, or losing, whatever. That dip in between those two climaxes can be a bridge story. That anything that is well written is great, but I think when you're talking about it in a role-playing game, that's not where the action is. If your action,
and
whatever
in
your
my
action
case,
is.
Those are the games I look forward to the most.
Well, and here's where it came up for us most recently. Now, once again, not for the first time, but most recently, was we had a game where their group had just wrapped up a contract and was making a long journey, literally a 6-month journey, back towards a planet near Earth. In the Battletech universe, you're basically not allowed on Earth, but they were going to a planet near Earth. And we had a lot of stuff to deal with because they had captured some assets, they had lost some assets, there were a lot of character developments that had sort of been set up but not fully played out, a group had surrendered to them, so they had new people to integrate culturally, tons of NPCs to figure out. In terms of character advancement, I owed them a bunch of skill points that they wanted to do. There was a whole lot of purchasing they wanted to do. It was tons of financial bookkeeping, character bookkeeping, cleaning up role-playing loose ends, and then, of course, at the end of that game, trying to get a contract for the next job.
Chad, you mock me, but a month with a small laser on your mech is 1 month too long. Shopping needed to be done, gone and done.
And what came out of that was a bridge game. Mm. A game where in and of itself, there were some neat RP moments, and it was a necessary game.
This is where a lot of things happened, yet nothing happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm curious, what do you guys think about that? Because I think there are three approaches, generally speaking, you can take to it. I'm curious what your guys' takeaway was from that bridge game, where Chris, in your case, moved to St. Louis. But beyond that, what's your thought on bridge games in general?
Well, like I said, I look forward to them. I mean, not the bookkeeping aspect of it, because the bookkeeping aspect got a little too much.
Right.
There's a lot of numbers involved.
You're the frickin' bookkeeper, Wayne. Deal with it. It's your corporation. I'm just an employee.
The other part of it you mentioned, the tying up the role-playing loose ends and things like that. You have role-playing moments when you're in the heat of the battle, but a lot of that gets shaken out when you're not in deep in the story. You know, when you have these bridge games, a moment to calm down, let everything collect. I think some of the best role-playing is done in those moments. And that's why I look forward to those games. I love the mech combat. The mech combat is fun.
Right.
And in other games, I've enjoyed the combat sometimes. Sometimes I haven't. But it's always those moments between the combat where the characters are talking to each other, having a party, something like that. Those are what I look forward to more than anything else. And you need those other moments in the game to get to that bridge moment.
I have to agree with you because you're right. There is so much action that you really don't have a chance to let that shake out in the role play. And the bridge game is that anticlimax where you can say, dude, your dad's dead. How are you dealing with this?
Again.
I kind of like those moments. I might have like a small agenda of things that need to be taken care of. But usually that involves, you know, trying to get things set up for like the next plot hook or whatever. But I usually I'll let my players kind of set the pace and the agenda of things that they want to do. Okay, you know, you're back in town. You know, what do you want to do? And I'll try and do some notes for that. You know, in fact, the perfect example was the start of this most recent adventure, the group that I'm in. I knew exactly how I wanted things to get going, and I had stuff to move the plot in that direction. But I knew them just getting back into town, they had their own agenda of stuff they wanted to do. And so I just kind of let them decide what they wanted to do. You know, what do you want to do is basically what I said to them, and let them go. And one guy wanted to go to the shop, you know, and one guy wanted to visit his girlfriend, and we all just kind of went around the table and took care of a lot of that stuff. But like Wayne said, just those really nice little RP moments where you can get some really good character development going on there.
I think the technical aspect of that is what bores me the most. The shopping,
right?
The yeah. bookkeeping, the, you know, oh, I have 6 skill points to spend, because it does not happen in serial and in unison with the players. You know, it's like you might have one guy who's going shopping and flipping through books. You might have one guy who's playing around with his character sheet to spend skill points that they have. All of this is totally legitimate.
One guy found a baby and is watching it run into the table over and over again and giggling and forgetting about it. Connor stays over with Beth and me at our little end and mm-hmm. runs into things.
And then you'll have another character who either doesn't have this stuff to do or finished up earlier stuff. And while that's going on, they are sitting there bored. Phones come out, gaming books get flipped through while you wait. And again, it's legitimate for everybody else to have to do this. I think it's incumbent upon the game master, if he is not engaged with another player, shopping, rules, whatever,
right,
to identify those players and try and kick up some RP with them. It's a good opportunity for the game master to flesh out some of the stuff with that character and even interject maybe plot hooks that they had waiting.
I think that's something I kind of dropped the ball on, because you're right that there is a downward trend where mm-hmm. people are flipping through the books. They're not interacting. They're not connected.
And it gets worse the more people that don't know the system, because they need
a lot of guidance and whatnot. Yeah. And one thing that I did not do was proactively create action for the people that were done, mm-hmm. not yet started, waiting on a book, whatever. I will give myself props for one thing, which is I think I did a pretty good job of when one of you guys declared something, I did at least play off that.
Right.
You told me, for example, that you were going to try and do a first run inventory and clean out mm-hmm. of one of the captured dropships.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to,
we got a little,
I tried to flesh that out yeah. into some more RP. When Pat told me he was going to start hitting on one of the NPCs, that turned into some pretty good RP with Pat, John, and then eventually Beth inserting herself into it.
And what I enjoyed that you did there was particularly we would come up with an idea. You had your basically your check notes of here's what I need to get through for this bridge game. Instead of trying to present those to us, you just worked it into what we were going to do anyway. You know, we needed to know about this NPC character, the one that Pat ended up hitting on. So here's a chance to bring her in.
Yeah.
I think that the Game Master also needs to look at what is going on technically. Again, the examples of shopping and updating characters and that sort of thing. And seeing what of that can be done later. Some of it can't be. Some of it shouldn't be. Some of it can wait. I think that the Game Master needs to look at the other players, see who's bored, who's not doing anything, try and help them out, and do some RP and stuff with them.
I agree with what you say, Chad. You know, and like I said, where I might let my players set the agenda, I think it's up to me as a game master to really set the pace. Because, you know, what you do say is true. If you spend too much time with one player and their activities, yeah, then the other players are going to get distracted. And so even if they don't get to finish that activity, you as the GM have got to take that responsibility to find a moment within that activity with that player, pause it, and switch to that person whose distraction threshold has been reached. And then you got to re-engage them, bring them back in, and then make that course around the table if that's what you need to do in that situation.
What I've also seen work is trying to take that time frame that's being used on all of this bookkeeping and shrink it down by assigning the more knowledgeable players to the not as knowledgeable.
That's a good move.
Basically, everyone's involved because everyone's talking to everyone else. The newer players just bring their numbers at the end to the GM for a stamp of approval or a denial. That way, nobody is sitting there doing nothing because everyone's interacting and moving towards getting it done quickly.
I also think some of this is incumbent upon the player, too. And I don't do it enough myself recently, but I am always in favor of character, hobbies, and projects. It's not you're standing there in front of your mirror on the long voyage practicing your quick draw skill. The player is trying to do something. They're trying to build something. They're trying to make something. They're trying to run a business. They're trying to write a book. It's something that adds color and flavor to their character, and it kind of grows the character, goes beyond
it. Oh, yeah. Hell, I mean, look at our D&D campaign. I was trying to create a gnollish society.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
that's not what the game was about.
Right, but that was a major interest, and that was a major push in my character. And actually, right along those lines, there is something I've experienced a few times as a player. I can't say all the time, which is I wish the Game Master would give us a bridge game because I have this list of, man, I really want to check in on my Knoll tribe.
Yeah.
I really want to do some shopping. I really want to catch up with some NPCs I really like. But holy crap, it's just go, 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 go.
And see, that's how like I run a game. It's very hard for me to put a bridge game into something like that because in my games, time is very compressed. I like playing hour by hour by hour. Like hell, our first half of our campaign took place over, what, 48 hours? And that took us months to do.
Every time you tell the story, it shrieks.
Well, I mean, no, it was like 2 or 3 days, wasn't it?
No, it was like 3 weeks.
No, it was less. I'm going to cut between you guys. I think it was about a week. It was more than 2 days, but I don't think it was several weeks. It was about a week or so. Because, yeah, all it really...
Because we were making 24 jokes a lot. It's like, this is the worst day in these characters'
lives. Well, yeah, because, I mean, really, all that, those first several months consisted of was a trip from one town to another. And we're not talking New York to L.A.
Right.
I mean, this was a short.
You know, the sad thing is, I based it around our performances when I gather how much time we did.
Yeah.
We performed 3 times within the city of Mattoon.
We
were there at least 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's how I was able to figure out time wise.
That's true.
So here are my 3 basic takes on bridge games, broadly speaking. I think
they're not necessarily bad, but they're not necessarily good either.
That was going to be one of the takes.
What you should do is silently evaluate everyone's role play for 4 hours, and anyone who's not good enough, you should penalize them experience points. John's last word.
I wish we are going to start a new Fear the Boots segment here, which is John reads out of context. He had a good quote for us out of context from a second edition book.
Oh, yeah. Okay, anyway, tell your stupid advice.
Yeah, while he's looking that up, I'll give my 3 basic approaches. Approach 1 is you just say, look, Bridge games are downtime in the action. It's paperwork. It's not what my group's about. We're just not going to do them. You can handle what you need to handle offline, shoot emails back and forth, assign experienced players, inexperienced ones, have people arrive early, stay late. You just don't ever slow the game down to deal with it. Possibility number two is...
You know what I like in your number one, where it's a very compressed game. It's very go, 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 and do this, do this, do this. Even if you're not, you don't have a lot of downtime. I think that if the players are amicable to it, you could do a day in the life of. It's like, you know, it's the plot, it's the plot, it's the plot. And now we're going to do this sort of side episode. And it's like, yeah, the big bad isn't quite storming the gates right now.
This is the episode where everyone goes to the beach and wears bikinis.
Well, I don't know about a beach episode. You could do that, too. I do. But there's a lot of stuff that goes on with a player, with a character that just isn't dealt with in-game. You know, where they eat. You know, it's like you could do... dinner, a game where they go to a tavern, they have a dinner, they're talking about their plans and all this stuff. Yeah, it's not swinging from chandeliers and fighting dragons and stuff, but you could really get into the character aspect of it.
What does it say about our group that we eat in character a lot?
It says, Cleric 1, I pop it up a few inches and put it aside slowly. Can I see anything? A reading from the 1989 publication of the Player's Handbook, 2nd edition.
That explains everything. I know why we talk about food so much. Okay.
That's right.
The second suggestion is to take it to the other opposite extreme and say, look, bridge games are great for my group because they want that downtime. They want that time to evaluate how events are impacting their character. And so you intentionally put them in there. You let them drop for a little while. You have those built-in breaks in the action. And then the third is to strike a balance between the two. Say, okay, the bridge games are necessary, maybe even a little bit of fun, but we don't want them too often or going on too long. And so you find ways of mitigating them, which things like coming up with proactive RP scenes, both from the player and from the GM, making the paperwork as simple as possible, maybe trimming it down by doing some work offline, but you still allow it to occur at the table in measured doses. And I think that's the approach that's best for our group, is to allow it to happen in measured doses, because Wayne enjoys it. I enjoy them. In fact, as I said, there's been campaigns where I'm like, damn, I wish the GM would give me some downtime. I want to develop something, and I don't have the chance to do it because I'm constantly running to or from somebody.
You can let the players dictate the speed of the downtime action, too. In my wizard game online, I very frequently say, okay, dudes, you're back at the manor. The sun's going down, and you're done with crap for the day. The world is alive. The NPCs are all doing what they're doing. I don't say this all every time, but this is the point. Do you have anything you want to do? And sometimes they say no, and sometimes they say yes.
I think this may also just be one more thing on the list that GMs are nervous about going in, thinking, yeah, this is something that they just have to do. And the players may not even notice it in the course of the game. They're just enjoying those RP moments.
The opposite can happen, too. We had the monks on the dropship in our recent Battletech game, and they turned out to have something to do with the plot, but we were all like, we're buttoned in, we're about to drop the dropship and lose it. We're all freaking war mode, shooting up on our PCP. We don't really care about the Eightfold Path at the moment.
Yeah, to explain monks, we don't mean like kung fu. We mean like
no, we mean like Buddhist yellow monks. Robes, yeah. Buddhist monks.
Chris, anything?
Chris?
Well, I think this is funny enough to keep going.
So you guys covered it. I mean,
hey, there he is!
Did we wake you up?
We're deciding whether to edit that out or leave that in.
No, leave it in.
All right. So the main.
Da, 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 da. Oh, sorry. Matt Luck's over, guys.
All right. So the main topic for today is.
That's not the main topic?
No, that's not the main topic. Oh. That's the main topic. We have to draw us out for another half hour.
I was going to say, oh, crap.
What's the other topic?
The other main topic for this episode is I want to talk about campaign level play. Now, Chris, Chris pointed out in our show formulation thread that...
I guess I should have read that thread.
I need to define my terms here carefully.
What do you do at work?
He reads the one where we're bickering about Occupy Wall Street and ignores the ones where we're planning the episodes.
You got that right.
That's blocked for me at work. I can't read any
it's
of
okay.
it.
It's okay.
When I say campaign level play, I am not talking about a campaign in the usual RPG sense. I mean, 99% of the time that word comes out of my mouth, I mean a campaign as in these are all sessions or sittings that combine together to form one long story. That is a campaign of D&D or a campaign of Battletech. When I talk about campaign level stuff, I mean like the theater of war. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about playing the game at a strategic level. Examples of this. You run a kingdom in D&D. You have your adventuring party or your PCs or whatever they happen to be.
Peons.
But you also have hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of peasants and soldiers and whatever else and threats
they
to the kingdom.
They have 1d4 hit points, and even if they manage to survive getting scratched by a house cat, they play dead anyway.
And you have
third edition.
You have tax rates to manage in our Battletech campaign.
High, very high.
This just came up when another group surrendered to your group, and then you guys went out on a purchasing spree, and you went from having your group of player characters with their five mechs, which is kind of bizarre in Battletech, but there are five people. We had to do something.
And we're an irregular, crazy guy unit. We can do whatever we want.
Well, and then you guys purchased and fleshed that out to be five mechs, several vehicles, and then about an additional 12 mechs piloted by NPCs that either surrendered to you or were salvaged from the battlefield or whatever.
And did not bring 100 million C-bills of maintenance crew with them.
And then on top of that,
we're too good to get shot at.
There's contract negotiation, support staff, paychecks. When we hit down on the planet, this just happened to us in the last game we had. Mm-hmm. I came with some rules on, okay, well, here's how we'll abstract high level movements. You know, I'll put down a map and you guys can move your lances and your units around this map and they'll move around and we'll take turns. And when units collide, you know, we'll deal with what happened. We found that for us, that wasn't working. Mm-hmm. So my question here is, and I've got a whole bunch of different questions and little niches of this topic I want to explore, varying from NPCs to RP to finances to combat, is handling these high-level games that involve a lot more resources than just your party. Hell, even if it's just your party, what if you happen to be there at the Battle of Helm's Deep? There's hundreds or thousands of combatants on the field.
Start rolling dice.
Yeah, do you guys really want to dump
roll.
A bucket.
Old man, strength check, one. Okay, you fire your arrow by accident. It kills an orc.
The one parameter I'm going to set on this.
You can't miss that field.
I'm sure that we are going to reference various games. What I am not looking to discuss here is best rules for dealing with this, because many systems have presented their own rules mm-hmm. for campaign level play. Battletech had its system through Battleforce. D&D has had multiple attempts at campaign play. I believe the Burning stuff has their take at it. I'm sure lots of games do it,
right?
But
to me, that's all mechanics. I want to talk about the abstract.
Yes. All right.
How do you
we
make
need
it feel
all
like
the mechanics
more than just
to keep
numbers.
Our freaking mechs alive?
Well, all right, let's start actually on the
Chad got it.
I did.
On the opposite side of this, which is with the RP. One of the things that occurs when you are dealing with a large number of people is you have a large number of people. And these are people who are not transient NPCs. These are people who are recurring fixtures of their life.
Unless it's a game about transients and hobos. Campaign level rail yards. Hobos, never mind.
We created an RPG out of a rail game.
Hey, my hobo has a shotgun. Just saying.
Hey, I am the hobo king. I have to deal with all this paperwork and logistics bullshit to get my people beans.
But, you know, assuming you're not just dealing with...
Here come the bulls.
You have to roll boxcars.
Very
I couldn't
nice.
Think about delivering yes! that. I thought of it.
Yes! Johnny and I have been setting that one up for months.
Years.
I don't know that you guys just won the internet. All I can tell you is I just lost the internet.
Yeah. Pat for moderating host.
but I have something Pat apparently didn't use often enough.
Oh.
I gotta take the safety off first.
Apparently you don't know how to
in there. It's cocked. Oh, thank God.
Thank God it was left cocked. safety on fear of the boot. Anyway, so
remember to use protection, a 12 gauge.
How do you guys want that handled? Or when you've run games, how
have
you handled
so
that?
So many little aspects of this. Let's break this down.
Yeah, let's start with the NPCs.
No, I want to start with a different part. I want to start with bureaucracy and logistics.
Okay.
Because say you're playing space, future fantasy, steampunk mashup with dinosaurs. Johan, suddenly, it was like, oh my God, they're talking about me. So you have that, and you have this big army of steampunk robots on dinosaurs versus the space ninja Vikings. And you want to play at a certain level. You want to say, well, we have this kind of income, and we have these kinds of expenses, and we want to have these kind of resources, but we can't afford these other kind of resources. Well, then we're starting to talk about a lot of numbers, talking about spreadsheets, we're talking about like a bureaucracy. And that's kind of what we have in our BattleTech game. And one of the failings of our current BattleTech game is that there's only one person running the bureaucracy. Because to my mind, the bureaucracy, if you're into this, the bureaucracy aspect and the accounting aspects of it are the fun part of the game.
I agree with you.
The bureaucracy is expanding.
I agree with you.
And I think bureaucracy. That
you should take the players who are interested in this, and even some of the players who aren't, and you should chop up the bureaucracy. Somebody should be the quartermaster. Somebody should be the hiring agent. Somebody should be this. You
know, and let me agree with you on two parts there. Let me start with...
No, I disagree.
Oh, let me agree. Start with the part about it being fun.
Yeah.
While record keeping is fun for a handful of people, for most people, it's not too fun. But what is fun about it, I think for a lot of people, myself included, is you have to figure out how to juggle those resources.
It's the decisions.
And that's a strategic and tactical level decision of, look, if we buy...
Do I want to get 20 archers or do I want to get one catapult?
Well,
or
do I hire none of the above?
Yeah.
Because it'd be better to know for sure I can pay these guys if it turns out the dragon didn't have a horde.
Yeah.
Happened. Chad's like, buy me a satellite. And I said,
guys,
no,
we could retire
to pay
on
us.
This even if we get like 5% a year. So what are we doing?
Yeah. But it's you have to make that decision of, look, we only have so much to spend.
Yeah.
And especially once it gets down to the wire, spending here means not spending there. Yeah.
And making the mistakes, too. You make a clerical error or...
error. You don't heal in time.
John's on fire today. But what I mean is, like, you either make an error and the game master catches it and suddenly you get 10,000 arrows show up from the arrow maker instead of 1,000. Or it's something like you make a decision that's not a good decision. And then you have to, in character, answer to the boss, who is Wayne in this case, who's the king or the lance commander or whatever. And, you know, you have to explain why you came to this battle where you had all of this huge armor and shimmering knights and all this great stuff, but you didn't have a single archer anywhere in your line.
Well, or you hired all these
riding pterodactyls.
And they're right, yes.
You hired all these guys and came with all these great resources. The battle didn't go wonderfully. You've now got an army that's not only defeated and you can't afford to rebuild, you can't afford their paychecks.
Yeah.
And
suddenly it becomes a non-campaign level game. It's about five guys sneaking out of the castle in the middle of the night.
It's about sailing to the Netherlands to get more loans.
So, I will say, I think there are two ways you
can
help.
I would love
help.
To play that game.
It would be John Adams' The D20 System.
There are two
it's
ways.
It's a great miniseries.
It was a great miniseries with a great theme song.
Yes.
John made us listen to it before each of the Goblin games.
Yes, I did.
I have no idea what John Adams had to do with goblins. But
well, I changed the theme sometimes. When it was going to be a political game, we played John Adams. When it was going to be a military game, we played Die Wacht am Rhein.
Two things I'd recommend is, first of all, there are things that you can automate. And once again, this is going to depend on the rule system. You might find things out there where people have already built tools for automating it. If you're even just decent with Excel, I'm using actually Google Documents, but let's be honest, it's pretty much a spreadsheet Excel sort of ripoff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can set up worksheets. Like, I have a contract thing where I can just plug in the roles you guys made, and it tells me this is what support's going to cost, this is what the payout is, this is what the salvage is, et cetera, et cetera. And it does all the math for me.
If I didn't have a laptop issue a couple weeks ago and we actually translated that over, I could have told you how long we can afford to keep paying everyone before we have to start firing
people. That was going to be the next thing, and Chad is 100% right. The fact that right now we only have one person doing it, and that one person is the GM, is a double whammy. We need to have multiple people doing it. There should be somebody who's the quartermaster.
I want to be a department head. I want to be in charge of something. I want to get a budget. I want to have responsibility. I want to either make mistakes or good decisions within my realm.
And in previous campaigns, we have split that out. We had a guy who was the quartermaster, typically Kevin. He knew down to the missile and down to the point of armor what the supplies were. We had someone who handled hiring, who handled contract negotiation. Mm-hmm. And we need to split that up again. We need to get everybody involved because, one, that frees up me as the game master. And two, that gets you guys more invested. When we have to do bookkeeping during a bridge game or a regular game, instead of sitting there and watching, you guys have your own jobs to fill.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the question comes up, what if you have a person or people in your game who are just not into that? And I think the answer is that you gauge their level of, are they really totally, I do not want to do this aspect of the game. I think that it's okay to give them a part that is so nominal as it never comes up, or just not to give them a part.
I think it's fine to not give them a part. What Pat, Beth, and I did while you guys broke out the spreadsheets 2 games ago was go to the mess hall. Mm-hmm. Pat asked for an NPC chick he could hit on. I followed Pat in to screw with his attempt. Beth followed Pat in because she's jealous of an NPC in a tabletop game. And then it just devolved into this horrible, like, four-way crossing Midsummer Night's Dream. Everyone wants to bang, but no one wants to bang the person that wants to bang them.
And to up the ante, I promoted the NPC that she's jealous to to be at the same level as she is and running one of the lances.
It was great. It was wonderful. I am going to do more with that NPC. That is going to be a constant adjutant to Beth in particular.
I have not seen Beth get mad in that campaign. She watched the lance blow up in game one with passive resignation. She watched our union go down with the serenity that the Buddhist monks would have envied. But when Pat's character started hitting on an NPC, it was load up the PPCs and the RMs. This broad is going down. So it's all about finding what motivates your players.
And I'm kind of in that camp, too. I mean, while I can certainly see the fun aspect of what you're talking about, I do that for a living during my day job. And about the last thing I want to do when I sit down at a gaming table is have to deal with a budget and with other department heads and with, I get that people like that. And I don't mind doing that kind of stuff to a degree. But, you know, like John just kind of said, you know, you got to gauge the interest of your players. Mm-hmm. And if they're really into that, but you're not as the game master, you might need to rethink whether or not that you really want to be running that.
Yeah, Chris, and I'm exactly so, with you.
Because if I was to run something, and I even talked about to my current group, say I wouldn't mind trying to do maybe some Battletech down the road, kind of set things out there where we would have this level of bookkeeping. But I know that as the GM, I hate that crap. And I'm only going to want to do it to a certain point. I'm not going to want to manage stuff down to the missile, and I'm not going to want to worry about my 10 or 15% overhead or whatever, because that to me, it's going to take away part of the fun.
See, if I were like an accountant, and then I went and I played my game, and they had this campaign level thing, and they said, okay, we need an accountant who's good at that, and then everyone looks at me, I'd go, no. And I get that. And I get what you're saying, Chris. I don't do that for a living. The closest thing I come to that is my own home finances.
You know what I was going to compare it to, actually, is the Total War series of video games. Mm-hmm. You get to play the battle. Mm-hmm. You get to play the politics. And you also get to, and I'm going to use get to, not have to, manage the kingdom.
Yeah.
And I enjoy all of those aspects of the game. Mm-hmm. They are different aspects of the game. But I enjoy all of those aspects of the game.
Chad and I have talked about so many times that the ultimate game along those lines would allow all three of us to sit down and take a different aspect. One person is the one doing the politics. One is the on-field general doing the commands. One is the person doing the resource budgeting and all work together.
Various forum communities have tried to do this with games like Shogun and Diplomacy. You kind of got to hold it together with duct tape and
split. Well, this game does not exist.
Well, right. Yeah. I know. I'm just saying.
It's like I
various approximations.
We're just saying it would be this the is ultimate cool. RTS.
Yeah, I think it's cool, and I would love to see it tried.
It's just like I want a base game where everybody's at a console controlling your console for the spaceship battle.
I like that too. I think that is more fun.
That would be fun.
It is fun. We play it at cons all the time.
Let's talk about NPCs now. When you're dealing with a campaign of this size, you're going to have a lot of people. Once again, assume this is not, you're just there for the battle, but these happen to be people in your organization or in your kingdom. These are people that you want to deal with. The way I've dealt with this as a game master is to start by saying, obviously, I cannot detail every individual, unless we're talking about an organization of 10 or 15 people. We're talking about a kingdom or this mercenary company, you know, which I told up has somewhere around 200 people once you figure in all the support crew and infantry and whatnot. I can't name every one of those. I can't give everyone's personalities. I mean, I guess I could, like, a random generator online. But even if I did, look, you guys aren't going to talk to most of these people.
Incontinent, curious.
Yeah, what I did
like my toad
instead was I went. I love that chart. What I did instead was I went through their unit and said, who are the people they're most likely to interact with? A, regularly, and B, in a meaningful way. And those are the people that I gave names, descriptions, personalities, and I keep that in a spreadsheet. And what I try to do is I try to keep it simple. Here's why. If I can't get to what I want to say about this person in three sentences or less, then what that means is this person is so nuanced, they either A, need to be a major NPC, not a background NPC, and or B, the interesting, catchy things about them are never going to come out in the role playing. If they don't have something that's very immediate, obvious, quirky in your face, when you have a staff meeting, it's not going to come up. And so there has to be something very almost stereotypical, something very colorful, very memorable about these people.
I think you need to do that with your player characters, at least at the beginning. I think far more people under emote than over emote.
I would agree with that.
I think for me, I need some of this to avoid having them just become numbers in the background. Using Battletech as our example again, because it's the obvious one to go to, I don't need to know everybody in a lance to not treat them like numbers, but I need to have at least a connection with one character in that lance. I have to have interacted with them. The person has to have a name for me to think of them as something other than this is a resource. Continuing the example, we had prop planes that we just sent out because...
Had.
Yeah, exactly.
They're so cheap.
We were in the same place that union's in now.
Yeah.
Battletech support vehicle heaven.
Was not willing to send out our big planes because besides them being resources, we've interacted with one of the pilots.
No, they're just
that
really
is a character.
Expensive.
Yeah, they're really expensive.
If the...
Like, losing those to get one snapshot of half of a battlefield?
Yeah.
Nah, we're headed for Chapter 7.
If the
prop Chapter 7,
if
there
the
is death.
Planes were characters, though, I would have had a second thought about just throwing them out there,
you
knowing
know,
they're probably going to get shot
because
down.
I actually even did roll to see if their pilot survived or not.
We don't care.
Well, and that's the thing is, I rolled the successfully ejected. At no point did anyone say, we're going to make even the slightest effort to recover these pilots.
Well, okay, the morality of war, they're trained in survival. They know how to bug out. This battle is lasting only minutes. We can't run off and dedicate a lance to pick them up.
We'll pick them up
when we're done.
What I'm laughing at is the fact that it never even got mentioned.
Well,
it was never even put on the to-do list.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm talking about.
Now, if the character...
But if it did, I still wouldn't have.
If the NPC that Pat was flirting with, if that character had to bug out, we would be asking about her.
Yeah.
Pat would. And Beth would, too. Beth would have been like, artillery strike on that position.
Danger hot.
What's a long time? Oh, yeah. All right. Boom.
And it's one of those things where I said, I don't need to see every character out there. But if like in our case, there are multiple groups, I do think you need to interact with somebody from each of those groups.
Well, and that's what I try to do is give each one a figurehead. For example, in the Battletech game, I don't have a name and a personality and description for every infantryman. But
there's only 30.
Plus your Marines.
Now.
You have 28 infantry plus your Marines. So it goes up from there.
The last mission, we had like 100.
But what I did do was I gave a...
We now have a drop ship.
I gave a personality to their commanding officer. And I also, in case he's not around, gave a personality to his second in command.
I've fought and bled with him.
With the vehicle corps, I did give a personality to the head of your vehicle corps. I think you could do this just as easily.
Ooh, wait, what? We have a vehicle corps?
Yeah, you actually... He's the guy that drives the Maxim.
Oh, we've just never interacted with him.
I don't want to know his name.
You did once in passing.
Yeah.
But I think you can do the same.
I don't like to learn the new recruits' names.
I think you do the same thing with like a D&D game. You can't name every smith in the city, but you could name the head of the Smith Guild. Or you could name the head of your family's preferred smithy. You could, for example, have heads of churches.
Or just a really what the game master would consider a very interesting, even if not important, NPC who just shows up and is interesting.
Yeah.
And you never know who your player characters are going to engage with. Yeah. How many conversations did we have with the coffee shop owner?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of that, when before we left the planet, I even was floating the idea of, do we have room for a barista? Because this guy's really nice, and he makes a damn good cup of coffee.
And what's he earning in Atarian space? 7 moo-moos an hour? It's not going to be hard to hire him off.
Yeah.
This is a C-bill. People want it.
I pay you in American dollar. Yeah. The last point that I want to hit on with campaign play, and this one's kind of a multifaceted point, I'm going to set it up as combat. But I think combat really served as a gateway to a bigger question. And the question that combat raised was, how much do you really want to know versus abstract? As I said, I came up with some house rules, and I borrowed fairly liberally from Battle Force and from Mercenaries, but I came up with some stuff of my own to just kind of say, well, here's how we're going to move pieces around a world map, and when two pieces collide, here's ways we can do some die rolls to roll off to see how it goes. What we quickly found was, for our group, for the type of game we wanted right here and right now, this was wrong. Mm-hmm. The detail was too great, even at that level of abstraction, the detail was too great for what we wanted. And so then at that point, I said, okay, stop. Let's just stop the game right here. We've made a mistake. Rather than digging the hole deeper, let's back out. What does everybody want?
I think it's important to look at, what is the main game? Whatever system that you're playing.
Right.
What is the main game, and what you do mechanically in that? How long does that take? Your strategic level, your top level stuff should not take as long as the core game, because then it starts getting in the way of the core game.
Exactly. Well, unless that is the core game.
Well, if you're not, if it's not, well, I mean, you're playing what you're playing.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you're abstracting and not abstracting.
And
that's
that
the
was
game.
The question that I think.
You either like the game or you don't.
We discussed, but we discussed later than we should have, which is, what does everyone want out of the campaign level play? And what came out of that was, you know, well, we'd rather just more kind of say, this group is attacking this objective. This group's attacking this objective. Let's just roll some dice and do away with the campaign level movement. Let's just drop units where they're going. And then, Dan, we can do some die rolls and descriptions about what happens. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, that's fine. But in return, that means there's less preciseness. So, for example, if you guys believe help is 6 minutes away, but in my mind, it's 6 hours away, you have to understand that this means there is now only one version of the truth, which is the version in my head.
And we accepted that happily.
Yeah, and you guys, and I know groups that would not, that they'd say, no, we want to know where everything is and what our options are. But you guys said, hey,
I will surrender the details of map simulation to your sense of plot in the service of getting to Battletech map combat.
Right.
And it actually adds something to the game for me, being able to say, this is your assignment to each of the groups, having them go do it, and us not know how that's shaking out. Mm-hmm. Because if we were actually our characters in the field, we wouldn't necessarily know how that's shaking out.
Or even better, you know, group A does this, group B does this, and we are group C. And we do our thing. Dan makes these secret roles. Okay, cool. Then we zoom into map combat, into group C, into us, and we're in the middle of it. And suddenly we're trying to work our objective. And then we get a radio contact saying group A has just blown it and they are being pursued and they need assistance. Yeah. And suddenly our objective changes and we have to make a decision on the battlefield of, do we take our objective or do we try and fight and pull our way out so we can intercept group A and help them?
Or better yet, their turrets turn off.
Yeah.
We don't need the radio from group C. We know they took out the power plant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, better yet, in this case, we reach the location. We assume group B was going to hit the power plant, take it, no problem. And we come into live turrets and we have to deal with it right there on the ground.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if my character wouldn't know what's going to happen, neat. I like having to deal with that.
And that's where I kind of like that type of approach, because while it is fun to kind of move big units around and roll some dice and kind of let fate decide really how the end result comes out, I think that human touch, more often than not, can make a more exciting and compelling story when you are zoomed in like that, when you just say, oh, this happens, or this is happening, or you get word that this happens, and then you have to then react to that. And that can be a bit more exciting than just rolling some dice to try and determine what really happened.
What we settled on was something that kind of mixes the two, where I lay out the world map, they move little those dice in this case, would it be chits or whatever around to show where everybody's going. And then what I say is, okay, logically, this group's a lot faster than that group, so their battle happened first. So what we're going to do is we'll look at the defenders and attackers, see if one of them has an obvious advantage in numbers or position, which may start with a modifier to one guy's roll. We roll compared dice based on the over-under. So let's say it's a straight even roll. Wayne rolls for their side, rolls an 8. I roll a 5 for the bad guys. Okay, Wayne's side, because in Battletech, higher is better. They're 3 over. So in the next roll, Wayne gets to add 3 to his number, because it's harder now for the bad guys to make a comeback. And we keep doing this. And then what we try to do is, as this is occurring, I try to tell a story. So, okay, they came in, roll the dice, Wayne rolls 3 over. I say they made some early successes. They caught the enemy off guard. It's not a real well-organized defense. They've taken the perimeters, but they haven't quite cracked the defense. Let's say the next roll goes just wildly sideways. Wayne rolls snake eyes. I roll boxcars.
That's more realistic.
And I say, you know,
that actually literally happened.
And that literally happened. Yeah. Like,
that's how we lost all the rest of Wright Company again when the heat got turned
on. It's like these guys rallied. They turned it from a losing situation to the 13 days of glory. And it's just a mess up there. These guys have really dug in. They have rallied in a way nobody saw coming. And at that point, they're like, well, we're going to send in some reinforcements. And it created this huge quagmire. This was prior to us saying these rules aren't working and rolling it back. Yeah. But nonetheless, that is still the way we handle the die rolls. What we changed was map level movement, not the die roll handling.
It's also fun when there's a million ties in a row, because that means they're just beating the shit out of each other and no one's surrendering or losing position. And then we almost blew up the second dropship doing that.
And every time there's a tie, I just hear cha-ching, 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 because that's money flying out the window.
Because both sides are being damaged. It's just they're being damaged equally. Mm-hmm. So
less salvage, more damage, less money.
Preparing to abandon the attempt to capture the asset and just destroy it and leave.
Yeah.
And I think, once again, the question that combat raised is the one that we should have raised at the start, which is, what type of game are we trying to run? What type of story are we trying to tell? And what level of detail do the players and game masters both want out of it? Because for some people, you know what? They may love the war game. They may love the idea of when there's a battle of Helm's Deep, you put out a huge area map and you push units around and do these roles and you fight it out at that detail. But that's not what our group wanted.
The problem is the tactical, strategic, Battletech abstraction kind of sort of game that we made up serves its purpose, but damn, it's not as fun as actually playing Battletech.
I think that's the important thing on any of the strategic stuff is, unless that's the game, like you're playing a game that is Birthright or whatever of the bazillion games out there where you can play this really high level, large unit type stuff. The top level thing is an aspect of fun. It's not the fun, and it should never eclipse what the players do for fun, whether it be role playing or combat or map Battletech combat, whatever. It should be something that enhances the game. It shouldn't take up a huge amount of time. It shouldn't distract. It shouldn't make things not fun.
I would also say I learned out of that whole session that even if you're going down the wrong path and you've reached the point where this is impacting fun, it's not too late to just stop, say, whoa, this isn't working.
Oh, hell no.
And we
can rewind.
Do it.
Yeah. It led to a much, much longer game, you know, that led far into the night. But in the end, we were all happier with the results because none of us, neither, you know, Dan as the GM or us as the player, we're actually getting what we wanted out of that session until we stopped and rolled back.
You know, and I got to say kudos to you guys for doing that, because I think the common behavior for most groups, even if it's not working, is to continue to plow through in the hopes that it is going to work. And while that may be a bit of a
tabletop gaming method,
while that may be a bit of a jarring thing and kind of a fourth wall breaking kind of thing to stop and say, whoa, wait, it's not working, and pull back and then start over, or whatever you end up doing.
Oh, that works.
You know, the fact that you're able to get back into it, revise, and move forward is pretty good.
Before John took that in all kinds of wrong directions, the actual relevant point I was about to make is, Chris, I will have to say, I mean, not to strain my arm, pat myself on the back here, but I am proud of us as a group for doing that, because too many times in the past, the response I've seen from groups is instead to bitch about it and then pass aggressively kill the game. Yeah, yeah. And it says, as opposed to just manning up or womaning up and saying, let's deal with this. What's wrong here?
I think it's very important to try new things in your game, even if your game is like some tried and true standard, to try new and different things. Now, the games I run, I am always trying new things, possibly even too many new things. But when you try...
Your game is just a new thing every day.
It is. It's wonderful.
It's new NPCs with the same name. It's new rules where there were old rules.
But was it fun?
It was a ton of fun. I'm sad I missed 9/10 of it. Damn my law license.
But I think that when you try the new aspect of something in a game, it's okay to stop and rewind and roll back if it doesn't work.
Well, I think that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. So I want to thank you guys, as always, for tuning in. Remind you to check the show notes. As of right now, I believe we do still have transcripts getting made. They're a little bit in arrears, but that's okay. It's a free service. So, and he's doing a great job. So I will not complain one bit. It's really
Control F John for all the good parts of Through the Boots.
That's how I find all the parts that I do when I'm not on the show. When you guys talk about me when I'm not on the show.
So I want to thank you guys for tuning
in. Show, Chad.
Yeah, I
am. I want to thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Through the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.